But in the middle of all this, there was serious racing going on. The serious guys knew there were the booger artists there. And Andy said, we had this guy from Chicago, his name was Tom Pistone, and we didn't even pay him. He wasn't a booger, and he used to flip better than the real guys did. And that's the connection. But Tiger Tom showed up there one time in the early 50s as a fruit and vegetable peddler. No racing background, no nothing. Wound up at Soldier Field one night and watched all of this and bought a race car the next day and was on the speedway. He didn't know anything about setting up cars or anything. And so Andy told him, said, that's no problem. We can get you set up right now. He had a bunch of guys jump on the front bumper all on the left side, and they chained the left rear axle to the frame when they had the car sagged down with everybody standing on it, and told Tiger Tom she was ready to race. Had the wedge set in her. Somebody bumped him in the rear end that night, and he flipped three or four more times. But Tiger Tom, through all of the carnage and the hoopla, is the winningest driver in Soldier Field stock car history. He became just the all-time winner. Won was the track champion, I think, 3 years in a row.
He kicked their asses.
He had the last laugh. In addition to Tiger Tom, also coming out of Soldier Field and Granatelli's Theatrics was a guy named from Elmhurst, Illinois. Who would that be? Fred Lorenzen from Elmhurst, Illinois. He was a Soldier Fielder. And also, I didn't know this till today, Darryl Derringer was a big wheel at Soldier Field.
And also Sal Tavella.
Yes, Sal Tavella. So, Soldier Field raced stock cars off and on. NASCAR went there a few times in the 50s, but then it became a USAC arena, and they made it to about 1968 when, according to most knowledgeable folks, the hippies made them stop racing because they thought government spending shouldn't go to such frivolous things as stock car racing. The great history of Soldier Field ran silent after 1968.
Because of a bunch of hippies.
A bunch of hippies. Long-haired hippies.
Tiger.
Don't even get me started on government spending.
Tiger, Tom, are you there, buddy?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Hey, feel free to chime in, Tiger. I'll give you a good warm-up.
You didn't tell them how many times I flipped.
You never got paid for it either, did you?
No, didn't know any better.
Tiger, buddy, it's good to have you back on our show again. We really appreciate you taking some time to come on here. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Good.
Yeah, man. Hey, Soldier Field, you had the number, didn't you, man?
Well, Andy Granatelli was a promoter. He was the sharpest of all. That's why I keep telling everybody, look for his book, Mr. 500, Andy Granatelli.
Yep.
He tells it all. He tells every bit that he did and how he did it. The white flag was the winner, you know. If you took the white flag, you better not take the checker flag. And that's the way he operated down there.
Huh. Wow, that's interesting.
You now, always raced to the checkered flag, didn't you, Tiger?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know any better the first year. You know. And Jim Rathman, I became very close to him, and he come up to me and told me, he says, Tom, he says, don't let it go to your head. He says, you ain't winning these races. We've been back and all for you. And I didn't believe him. I told him, I ain't want you to go take a walk, you know. I was real cocky then, you know. And I got hooked up with Vince Ignolfo and Sonny Ignolfo. And they're the ones that got me involved in racing in Chicago.
So is that story true that you showed up as a fruit vendor initially when you saw your first race there?
I never heard of racing in my life. I was 21 years old, and Vince Ignolfo was working for Vince Granatelli in a muffler shop. And Vince, we had a gang in Chicago that we called the Lashers, and Vince said, let's go racing, and that's what he did. He brought me to Soldier's Field, and that's how we got started. And I didn't know an apple from a cucumber.
Well, we were earlier in the segment. Somebody asked about the surface there that it may have begun as cinder, What was the progression of the track surface, as you remember it?
No, it was always asphalt.
Was it?
It was a Soldier's Field where the Bears played football on the inside.
Uh-huh.
And then when we ran the races, they stuck a guard. They made a guardrail.
Uh-huh.
And the outside wall was all concrete, the outside walls. And they used to have fire hydrants. And Andy Grantelli put hay bales there. And, boy, when you hit those fire extinguishers, boy, you wrecked your race car.
Well,
Bowman Gray reminds me of Soldier's Field.
There was a very important race in Soldier Field history called the Police Benevolent Race. And
yeah.
Didn't you win that race a time or two?
Oh, yeah, three in a row. See, Andy Grantelli, the first race of the year was a Police Benevolent Race, and they used to pack 80 to 100,000 people up there. And the police used to go around to all the shops and businesses and everything else, and you better buy tickets. And back in them days, it was real rough. It was all mafia control, and the police controlled Chicago. The police worked for the mafia back in them days.
You mean they still don't?
A lot of guys didn't know that.
Wow.
But that was also a great promo kickoff for Granatelli. It put him on good community term standing, right off the get-go.
Oh, yeah.
He was the policeman's friend.
Oh, yeah. We have an average of 38,000 people back in the 40s and the 50s. Nobody could believe that. But he staged the races. They used to have backup races. They had horse races, pony races, ostriches races, elephants. He had everything that you could possibly think, you know. And he threw that to people. He was an entertainment. You got to get that book. You got to read it. Bill Francina read it. Humpy Wheeler read it. Bruton Smith, when I read it. There's a lot of guys read that book, and they learned a lot from it.
Now, Tom, tell us about when you first came down south. Did many of your racing compatriots welcome you with open arms?
I did not know my history. When I was in Chicago, I threw the history books out the window because I hated history. And now I'm sorry I didn't learn history. See, when I came down here, and I kept I couldn't understand what the people were talking about. They kept calling me Yankee, Yankee, Yankee. And I didn't know what they were talking about. So finally, my first stop when I first came down here, we stopped at this Golden Esso station in Winston-Salem. And I didn't know that Bill France Sr. and Alvin Hawkins owned it. And we stopped there to get some gas and some directions to the racetrack. And Bill France Sr. come out and he says, "Son, who are you? Where are you going?" I said, "We're going to Martinsville." And he said, "That race ran last week." You know, so he gave us, we worked on our car. And ever since that day I met Bill France Sr., I was connected to him to the day he died. If it wasn't for Bill France Sr., I would have never, never made it.
What did he tell you to paint anything on the hood of your car?
Yeah, he said, "If you want to get along with these, with the Southern people, you got to put down a converting Yankee, I see the light, and you paint a light bulb, and then it put the rebel flag on it, and then I start calling myself a Southern WOP."
So did that help any?
Oh, 100%. I said, "What are you guys talking about, Yankees? I'm a Southern WOP. I'm with you guys."
Oh, God, that's hilarious.
Tiger Tom.
Yeah.
This is Bill Rankin up in Gloversville, New York. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, Bill.
Elaborate, if you will, 1960, racing at Daytona. What type of life preserver, oxygen tube did you have installed in your car?
Well, see, Bill, a lot of people laugh about that. There, a lot of people don't remember. Tommy Irwin was in a 59 T-Bird. And these T-Birds were unit construction bodies. They were pretty well sealed. And you had to run your windows up. Otherwise, you couldn't run fast enough. Tommy went into the lake. And he stayed down for a long time. He stayed down there. And after he came out, I asked him, I said, "What happened, Tommy?" He said, "I lost the crank handle, and I was looking for it inside the car. And I finally found it." If he wouldn't have found that crank handle to turn the window down, he would never get out of there. He'd be still down there.
Wow.
And I says, "That's not for me, because I can't swim." So I went down to Daytona. I bought a life jacket, an aqua lung, and a tank. And I ran that three or four races until A.J. Foyt screwed everything up. He filled his tank up with nitrous oxide. So NASCAR outlawed the tank.
Oh, God, that's funny.
He was always looking for an excuse. AJ for how to cheat.
Now, Tiger, you never ran any cheated up stuff, did you?
I cheated all my life. At least I admit it.
At least you do.
Well, Tiger, you're from Chicago too, right? You know where I'm going with that, right?
Well, you can't call it cheat. What do you call it? There's a white page in a rule book. That's what do you call it now? I don't know. There's a special name for
creative rules interpretation.
You're way ahead of the game. It's just like Smokey Ute. You know, nitrous oxide, who knew about it? Smokey was in the Army. He learned that. And I couldn't understand why this guy kept, qualifying me, Fireball Roberts. And then until one day I found out he had nitrous oxide he was running, which was legal in them days. There was no rule against him, you know. Uh-huh. And nitrous oxide is still being used in NASCAR, you know. And I could tell you some real good stories about that.
Go ahead. Okay. We want to hear. We want to hear one.
It's hard to explain because I can't tell everybody about it. But nitrous oxide is still being used.
I've heard some of the drag racing guys talk about some of the consultations they've done with NASCAR teams. With nitrous oxide how to conceal it, how to use it, and all that kind of stuff. I think it's a really interesting subject. And, I can remember being at a race at Martinsville, a truck race, with a team that was doing some testing for Dodge. And DW, I think he ended up on the pole and got disqualified. Seems to me they found a little nitrous around DW. You think DW was capable of doing such a thing, Tiger?
Well, this all started back in the 50s now. This all started. See, Sterling Marlin had a car at Talladega, and Bobby Ellison was parked right next to him. And what Sterling did, he put this nitrous oxide bottle inside the sump tank, the dry sump tank.
Uh-huh.
And what happened, the heat made the tank explode, and Bobby Ellison standing right next to him, and he saw all this.
Uh-huh.
You know, the guys were hiding in their roll bars. They were hiding in their seat. They were hiding it all over the place, the nitrous oxide. You know, I remember one time I went to Dover, Delaware, and Felix Zapata wanted to get our car because his Kyle Palpetti didn't make the race. And I told my driver, I said, we can't give him our car. We got nitrous oxide still in this car. You know, and we had it built in the roll cage and at the firewall. We had it built, and that's how we qualified all them races, you know. And after my driver goes out there, the first lap wipes the car out. And Felix Zapata was going to pay us the whole purse, build us a new car, give us a new engine, everything, just to let them use our car. But we couldn't give it to them.
Wow.
Yep.
Couldn't give away the secret, huh?
So
don't let anybody tell you they're not cheating. You know, when you see a car run fast and he goes by you, I tell a guy, when you go by me, buddy, you better be cheating because I am. And that's how I learned all that stuff on these guys.
Oh, man.
So Tiger, was there a button that you mashed, or how did you activate it, the nitrous?
Well, we had electric solenoid. And then the later years, my son Sammy developed one with some 8-volt batteries. He designed it, and he put it on this 1-pound bottle, and you press the button, and the batteries would do it. In fact, I still got one left on my counter. I show everybody. I sold about 50 of those bottles. I sold. They're 1-pound nitrous oxide bottles, 10,000 RPMs. The guy who made them for us.
Wow.
So are they in legend cars now?
who knows? Bill?
That
who
legend
knows?
Million.
Who knows, he said.
Who knows? Like I used to tell Bill France Sr., you got to hire a thief to catch a thief.
Oh, you know what I mean? Oh, that's great, man.
That's why they hired Gary Nelson.
Yeah, exactly. That was what was on my mind. That's how Gary Nelson got the job.
Who was he disqualified the first race? His old boss, Felix Zapata. Don't you remember that?
Yep, absolutely true. Yep.
He knew what to look for, didn't he?
Yeah, he knew exactly what to go look for.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that's good stories. Very good stories.
So nitrous was known. Was that an outgrowth of World War II?
Yeah, well, they use it for the dentist. They use it for your the knock you out when you're when it's right on your teeth.
But how do you know the stuff that Dennis used to make an engine run faster? Who come up with
Smokey Unick. Smokey Unick. He was the first one, buddy. He was the first one to use that stuff. He was smart. Just how about that gas line they keep talking about at Daytona? They pulled his fuel cell out.
Yeah.
He drove the car home.
Yeah, I've heard that story.
Well, the true story is there was no rule on how long the gas line had to be and the size of it back then.
Uh-huh.
So he had a 50-foot, one-inch hose underneath the seat. That thing alone held 7 gallons of gas. And then back of the 60s, Freddie Lorenzen at Daytona, his mechanic, Jack Sullivan, he put down, shut the pump off, and nobody understood what he was meaning. See, Lorenzen had the cow, it was all built for a gas tank, and he had a pump in there. And that's how he ran those 100-mile races, without a pit stop.
Huh.
And then NASCAR got wise to that. There was so much stuff cheating. There was so much.
Now, did you
Jim Rathman was the bravest. His whole seat was a gas tank. He was the bravest man I ever met, Jim Rathman. A.J. Foyt and Jim Rathman, I say they were the ones. They knew exactly what to do. And they were real racers too. The best.
We have a show that Bobby Unser does on here occasionally, and he often talks about A.J. Foyt, and he said exactly what you did, Tiger. He's a hell of a racer.
Oh yeah, a hell of a creator.
Yeah.
All he knows how to is win. That's all he knows.
Yep.
And he was a good racer too. That's the best part.
Yep. Yeah, no kidding.
He could drive anything. I don't care what. I remember a time that him and Jim Rathman went to Sebring, and they drove those 40 cars,
Uh-huh.
And back in them days, in the 50s and 60s, the guys used to put their arm up. They used to put their arm up in the air and say, "I'm going in the corner. I'm going in the corner." And A.J. Foyt and Jim Rathman says, "Let them go in." Then they body slammed these guys. And he taught the road racers how to drive then. Never forget that. I was down there with Jim Rathman for that race at Sebring.
That's Jim's still alive, isn't he?
He's got a little dimension right now. And see, he was one of my best friends, and we used to talk all the time. And it's real heartbreaking, very heartbreaking.
He's about 83 now, Tiger? Is that about right?
No, I'm 82. He's about 84.
About
84? Yeah. He don't remember nothing, and that's the sad part.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't remember Jim Rathman. See, Jim Rathman came here in 57 in Georgia and put the Chevrolet team together.
Uh-huh.
He took over the Chevrolet racing team. And that's when he hired me and Anthony Vasura and Whitey Gerken from Chicago. And then we built these here cars. And I mean, they were cheaters, They were acid soap bodies and all aluminum roll bars. It was ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And the only guy that stuck up for me while I was building these cars was Rex White. He was the only one. Frankie Snyder, Jack Smith, Speedy Thompson, all them guys, they said, "You don't know what you're doing."
Huh.
And what we did, the first race was at Manassas, Virginia. I'll never forget this as long as I live. We went to the racetrack, and here's the Ford teams and the Chrysler teams practicing all week at Manassas, all week long.
Uh-huh.
And me and Rex White got off the truck, and I sat in the pole, Rex White sat in the outside pole, and we finished 1-2 in that race. and they couldn't believe it. Ford Motor Company confiscated our cars.
They called the Black Widows?
Yeah, the car was completely adjustable. There was nothing not adjustable. See, I designed the screw jack back in 1949, and today all the guys are running screw jacks. That's all you see in these cars. And my car was equipped with all the jacks, Porter power systems. There was nothing that wasn't on my 57 Chevrolet and Rex White's car. They didn't know what hit them, believe me. They didn't know what hit them.
Could you adjust it from the driver's seat?
Yes, sirree, 100%.
Good Lord. 100%. In the 50s, you could adjust weight from the driver could do it.
Right. There was no rule then, see? We had Porter powers in the car. We had everything. There was no rule.
So that's where that rule came from of no driver-actuated weight jacking system.
Right, exactly. Exactly. See, and
so you ruined it for all of us.
Yeah, when I came down in 1955, Lee Petty says, "What is that car?" He couldn't believe it. It was completely adjustable, all screw jacks and stuff like that. And he didn't know what to say. when he saw that car.
What, this was in 57?
55.
Wow.
55 is when I first came down there. And
but when did you have the adjustable car? What year was that?
1951. But then when I got NASCAR, I brought it to NASCAR. And then we put it on the 55, the 56, and 57 cars.
Wow.
Was y'all running that kind of stuff at Soldier Field?
100%. 100%. It was legal then. There was no rules then. Andy Granatelli owned Grand Corps Speedway. I mean, Grand
right.
Corps. And he used to build the engines. If you race for Andy Granatelli, you had to have your engine built by him. And he put a McCullough supercharger on these cars. And all the engines went through Andy Granatelli. So there was no rules, more or less.
Wow.
Yep.
That's amazing.
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
That's what that does is breeds a lot of creativity too, man. I mean,
you
got wide open rule book and all that. You changed the face of NASCAR when you came down here as that Southern Watt.
But even then, Tom, NASCAR was still the major league, wasn't it?
Oh, 100%.
You were drawn from Soldier Field to NASCAR.
Oh, 100%. All the racing and the good drivers were down south.
You didn't run any USAC or MARC or any of the other divisions, other circuits?
Did I race? I raced ARCA. I used to drive for Markham. I drove for USAC. Yeah, I drove for most of all of them. Mm. When you came down south, you know you had the best. You know, Curtis Turner, Joe Weatherly, you know, Fireball Roberts, Speedy Thompson, Frank Mundy, you know, the Flock Boys. These guys were on top. Keith Kaver, he was the one that actually modernized NASCAR, you know, when he kept those Chrysler 300s.
Were you in NASCAR in the Key Kafer era? Were you down here then?
I raced against him. Oh, yeah, I raced against him. You know, Carl Key Kafer couldn't figure out why my car would beat his car. So in 56, he came down to Daytona with a cam graph machine he came down there with. Was it 56 or 50? I can't remember what year it was. And see, we used to have special cams made by Howard Johansson. You ever hear of Howard's cams in California?
Yep.
Yeah.
We used to take a Chevrolet billet cam and he used to regrind it. So Carl Kiefer didn't understand why my Chevrolet was so fast. So he found out what I had, you know, because he put a graph machine on my camshaft.
How did he do that?
He brought a machine down there, cam graph.
How did he get hold of your cam?
Well, in NASCAR back in them days, when you go to the racetrack, you had to have the engine taken apart. They just have a garage inspection, and you pull the heads off, and it's your camshaft and all that. They check it before the race.
So other drivers had access to it if they wanted to see what it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, some of the guys were sharp. They had some snap rings in their grill, and they had the original cam snapped to the grill. And they pull out the cheating cam and hand the inspector the other cam. You know, it was one of them flip-flop deals.
The hand is quicker than the eye.
Smokey never done that, though, I'm sure.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Boy, these guys were sharp. They were.
So how was driving on the beach? What was that experience like?
That was a big experience. I'm sorry they quit doing that because it was very exciting. You know, especially in a convertible. I finished fifth and two and 50. Let's see, 56 and 57. I finished fifth in both of them races. Yeah, the convertible race.
Wow.
So Tiger, you were there in 1959 when everybody moved to the big Daytona Speedway.
Oh yeah, 100%.
So what was the general reaction of the drivers? When y'all pulled in the gate the first time and looked at that thing, what did everybody think?
Well, it was hard to believe that such a track could be so big, you know. And when we first went out in practice, you know, I'll never forget that either. You know, we're all in the line. And here's Lee Petty in the back, and he drives in between us, you know, and he made such a draft, he spun us out.
Wow.
And I mean, we spun out. So then NASCAR had a driver's meeting. And we started talking about this draft. See, Curtis Turner, I think, was the first one that learned it in 59. He hooked up with me, and he kept pushing me all over the racetrack. And I said, boy, this is neat, you know. And then you get behind him, you could push him. And you run half throttle. You know, and Curtis Turner, I think he was the first one that learned the draft. And then Junior learned it in 60 when he came down, when he won that race with a 59 Chevrolet.
Now, did you have side window glass in your cars in 59?
Oh, yeah, all through the car. You had to have the windows. You had to have them. See, and back then we had the solid, you know, standard seats. Well, we just took the one side off. You know, it was still on the tracks, the seats. The cars were completely stock with all the chrome moldings on them and everything. See, Bill France wouldn't let you take nothing off the cars. They looked just like when you bought them off the showroom.
Wow.
You know, and it was good. It was good. You know, and,
The cars were still pretty much like that in 61 when Lee Petty sailed over the fourth turn guardrail. It was still essentially a stock car, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. 100%.
A miracle he survived.
Yep, you're right, 100%. It's a shame that the Southern drivers are not racing today. That's what I can't understand. You know, you got mostly now all Northern drivers down here.
We had that discussion, I think, last week. Yep. We were talking about
sure
that.
Did.
You know, at one point in time, there were so many Southern drivers here, and now you can't really find one. I mean, I guess the only North Carolina driver is Dale Jr.
Yeah. Well, you got no money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You got no money. And that's right. The real Southern driver right now is Dale Jr. You're right. You're exactly right, 100%.
David Reagan out of Georgia.
And none from South Carolina?
Nothing
from South Carolina, North Carolina, you know. No. That's what I'm saying. You got, and there's a lot of good drivers, the Southern drivers, but they can't get the break. They can't get it.
And it's so true, Tiger. That is the case. And now, you know, it's gone from a talented driver finding a team and looking for a sponsor to a marketable driver finding a sponsor and looking for a team kind of deal, like Danica Patrick, not taking anything away from her.
Right.
But it's still it's just such a different situation now from the way the sport was built. You know, there's so many talented people that'll never get a chance to race.
Well, it's all endorsements. You know, that's right. So, Jeff Hammond, when he was working for Junior Johnson, I said it's all coming to it. You know, Jackie Arut was the first one to start doing that. Their souvenir deal with Darrell Waltrip, and it came bigger and bigger and bigger till today. You know. Yeah. It's just out of hand. I don't care how good you are today. If you're really good, you cannot get a ride.
Yep.
You got to have a sponsor.
You got to have the sponsor first.
You got to have the sponsor. And I don't care. And all them guys will tell you that. You know, Jack Roush, Rick Hammerich, every one of them. You got any money?
Yep.
And then they'll run you.
It's all about the money. Yep.
It's a shame. It's a shame. You know, there's a lot of good drivers. I got three grandsons. They're the best drivers in the world.
Yep.
And I can't get them a ride, you know. And just like Casey Roderick right now, he's good, you know. You can't find money. It's pretty hard.
Tiger, what do you spend all your time doing now, buddy? What are you up to?
I'm working with Marcus Smith, Bruton Smith's grandson, and Mike Joy. You know Mike Joy.
Yep.
I work with his son on the Bandoleros, you know, which is a real, real good thing, I feel. And I'm still trying to get a ride for Tommy and my grandsons. I'm still working on it. I've still got Craftsman trucks left. I still got my shop. I still got the capability of doing everything. And I'm working with Legend Cars right now as a consultant. And I don't know if I'm supposed to be going to work for them full-time next week. I'm supposed to give an answer. And I don't know if I'm going to do it or yet, because I like working on cars. I love working it.
Yeah.
Tiger, I got a question for you since you're really in the loop. How much of the car of tomorrow do the teams actually build, or do they build all of it?
To tell you the truth, I cannot give you that answer because I haven't been to one of them shops in 10, 15 years. I haven't been to one of their shops. It breaks your heart that you cannot walk in a shop and just go walk into the area, the work area. It breaks your heart. You got to have an appointment. You got to have... You know, it took everything away from me, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I came down with racing, and I stayed there, and I enjoyed living down south. And I brought Paul Goldschmidt, came down here a few years ago. And he says, Tom, take me to some of these little speed shops. You remember Paul Goldschmidt?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. We've had him on here a couple of times.
Yeah. He said that he's had a lady that was interested in going racing. He says, take me around to the speed shops and let me see what we can do. So the first shop I took him to was at the Concord Airport, Jack Rouse's airport, his place, and walk in there. I introduced myself to the lady, and I said who this was. He says, "I'm sorry, we can't let you in today."
Wow.
I was never so embarrassed in my life. And then a few months later, I met Jack Rouse at the racetrack. He came down there, was working with Mark Martin with the Bandolero kids, the cars, and I told him about it.
Uh-huh.
So Jack Rouse gave me a private number, and he says, "You make sure that never happens again," he told me.
Huh.
And that's a man, Jack Rouse. That's a real man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He cares. He does care. But, you know, you can't just let everybody in there. But just the idea, you like to go in there and just look at these cars, you know,
yeah.
Feel them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
But they won't do it. They won't do it.
Tiger Tom.
It's out of hand.
Always a pleasure having you with us and share some of your stories with us, man. You're a true pleasure to be around and a true legend. And we appreciate you so much, man, and look forward to doing this with you again sometime soon.
Thank you. And listen, Margaret, Larry Frank's wife, she's going to they're gonna induct Larry Frank in Daytona in February.
Uh-huh.
So give a call out for Larry Frank and his wife.
You got it. Larry Frank deserves it. And Margaret, we appreciate you coming and being a part of Racers Reunion and letting Larry's history be known. Thank you so much. And Tiger, again,
okay.
Man, you take care, buddy. We'll catch you next time. Thank you very, very much.
Bye.